I'm a Roy Hoosier and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I belong to the New South group in High Point, North Carolina. My wife gave me a note before I got up here. Be sure and thank the committee and say some nice things about Alma. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the people on this committee for inviting us up here this weekend. It is quite an honor. It was a good trip. We came up, we left Wednesday and drove up, and we're just taking some time off to enjoy our sobriety, my sobriety and her sameness through the program of Al-Anon. There are not many times I get the opportunity to say that, but I do want to thank the committee. This is quite an honor, and we appreciate being up here. I know there's been a lot of work has gone into this thing. You can tell it's well organized, and it looks like a fun weekend. I'm glad I'm the Friday night speaker. I can get it done, and I've got Saturday and Sunday to have fun. I'll tell you a couple of stories before I get wound up. They're not for your benefit, they're for mine. If I can tell a couple of funny stories and find out who's laughing, I'll settle down a little bit. I like this story. It's about the old boy was sitting on the front porch, and the river was flooding out in front of his house, and it was flooding into his yard and lapping at the porch, and he's sitting on the front porch, and a fellow came by in a rowboat, and he's rowing, and he hollered to him, and he said, "Come over and get in the boat, and I'll row you to some higher ground." And the guy said, "No, don't worry about me." He said, "I've depended on God all this time, and God will take care of me." So the fellow rowed on off. And a few minutes later, or a couple hours later, the water's up into the house, and this guy's sitting up on the roof. And the fellow comes by on a power launch, and he says to him, "Swim out to this launch, and I'll take you to higher ground." And the fellow says, "I don't worry about me. I've always depended on God, and God will take care of me." And so the power launch went off. A couple hours later, his cat's sitting on top of the chimney, and this fellow comes over with a helicopter, and he hollers down to him and says, "I'll throw you a rope and pull you up and take you to higher ground." And he said, "No," said, "I'll depend on God. God's always taking care of me, and so I'll sit right here." And so the chopper goes on off, and an hour later, the water runs down this old boy's pipe, and he drowns. And he winds up at the pearly gates, and he's mad as hell. And he said, "I want to see God, and I want to talk to him right now." And so God comes out, and he says to him, I've depended on you all my life. I've looked at you to take care of me, and you let me drown." And God said, "I sent you 2 boats and a helicopter." And another story that I like, and then I'll get into the business at hand, about the 2 winos up under the bridge. Now, this is my favorite story. And if many of you heard Tom Brady, you've heard this story, but I'm going to tell it again because I love it. About the 2 winos under the bridge, and they're asleep or passed out. And they come to, and one says to the other, said, "Man, I had a strange dream last night. Said, I dreamed that my mother found me up under this bridge and took me home and cleaned me up and fed me and got me some new clothes and gave me some money and sent me to Disneyland. So I had a wonderful time. Got to ride the rides and got to see Mickey Mouse and Pluto. It's had a good time." And the second drunk said, "I had a strange dream myself. Said, I dreamed I was in this big, beautiful hotel. Everything was perfect. Said, in the corner I had a bar loaded with liquor. And said, the door opened, in walked 2 of the best looking women I've ever seen in my life, a blonde and a redhead." And the first drunk, sort of excited like, said, "If you had all that liquor and those women, why didn't you call me?" And the second one said, "I did. Your mother said you'd gone to Disneyland." I'm a grateful alcoholic, and I'm a big book drunk. I don't believe in any program of recovery from the illness of alcoholism except the program as laid out in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't discuss any other program. I don't see how any of them work. And so I believe strongly in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in its instructions and what it tells us to do in order to get sober, remain sober, handle problems in our life, and even gets down to telling us how we are supposed to make a talk. And I try to stay within those guidelines. I don't know what I'm going to say when I get up here. I have never memorized a talk because I seem to forget it. And so I sort of sit down here, and while this good-looking thing over here was reading it, how it works, I'm praying like hell. I didn't hear a word you said, honey. I'm saying something like, God, I'm getting ready to get up there, and I'm going to have to talk to these people, and if there's anybody out there you want to reach, now's your chance. And I'm not going to plan it. I'm going to tell it as it comes. I want to tell you this much, that I was born in High Point, North Carolina, into the most normal family you ever heard of. Absolutely nothing abnormal about my family. No reason for me to become an alcoholic, except I got a bunch of drunk uncles. But my mother and father both were stable individuals. I had two sisters, and we were raised in a family that tried to instill in us all the elements of good living, the things that we're trying to learn today. My mother and dad took us to church every Sunday, and we were tried to given everything that it takes to grow up to be sane and sober and responsible. And something happened to me. I don't know what it was, but as soon as I was able to grasp the situation, I don't know whether I was 3 or 12, but I remember the minute that I knew where I was and what I was doing and what I belonged to, I didn't fit. I didn't fit in the normal family I grew up in. Now, I've been sober since March 15, 1972. That's 11 years, 6 months, and 1 day for you Michigan State graduates. He told me to say that. And I still do not fit in that normal family. I have tried to work this program to the best of my ability. I've tried to make amends to the family that I hurt growing up, and I still do not fit in that normal family, and I don't know why it is. The only two places that I have ever been comfortable in my entire life was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and a honky-tonk. I have always been comfortable. Since the day I went into either one, I've been comfortable. And I know if I get drunk tomorrow and go back to a honky-tonk, I'll be just as comfortable when I walk in that door as I was when I left. And I know that the first meeting of AA that I walked into, I knew I was home. I didn't know a lot about it, and I didn't stay, and it took me some time to get back, and I had a lot of trouble, and I'll tell you about that. But I felt good the first meeting I went into. Peggy and I ran off and got married when we were in high school. I was 18, she was 17, and she went back the next year and graduated, and I like to tell this because she's an Al-Anon. The last year of high school, her senior year, I signed her report cards. I think that's the last time in our marriage that I had the upper hand. I went in service when I was 19 or 20 years old. Now, I know that I was a hard drinker at about 16 years old. But I was young and I was strong, and I didn't have a lot of trouble with it, although I did drink to excess from the very start. But I went in service when I was about 19 or 20 years old, and I started having trouble in service because I was away from the influence of family. I was able to let my hair down more than normal, and I like to say this, I was a periodic drunk while in service. I got drunk as hell, spent all my money every payday for 24 months, and that's the only time I was drunk, because that's the only time I had any money to drink on. I would get paid and go downtown, get drunk, stay till it was gone. Now, guys would come back, at 12 o'clock, because that's what time we were supposed to be back. They would come back with money in their pocket. They would come back and they would be walking, not me. I went down, my intention when I left was to stay down until I could drink all I wanted. And it didn't make any difference to me if it was 12 o'clock. I wouldn't come back if it was 12 o'clock the next day. If I wasn't done drinking, I wasn't going to go back. And so I had a lot of trouble in service. I experienced blackouts while in service. I didn't know what they were, but I had blackouts while I was in service. And I'll tell you about one. I don't know what happened. I hit a baseball pool or I won a poker game or something, but I was in Europe and I had some money, $200 or $300. I don't remember how much, but a handful of money. And I decided I'd go and leave. I was making about $40 a month then. You couldn't do much traveling in Europe on that. And so I hit this big $200 pool or something, and I put in for a 10-day leave, and I was going to Paris or England or somewhere. I don't remember now. But I remember I left the barracks, and I made the mistake of stopping downtown to have a drink with the boys before I got on the train. And the next thing I remember is the next morning, And I didn't have any money. Maybe $8 or $6 or something. Even if you're in Europe, you can't go to Paris on $6. So, you know, I couldn't go. And I didn't remember throwing the money away. I didn't remember getting in a crap game, a poker game. I didn't remember throwing it away on any particular thing. And even then, I was 20, 21, 22 years old. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I knew there was something wrong with me, but I didn't know what. I didn't want to go into the room or to the hotel lobby where my friends were and say to them, you know, I've lost $200. Does anybody know where it is? Never known a drunk to be that honest. I wasn't. So I would say things like, we had a good time last night, didn't we? And one guy said, yeah, I reckon. No big deal. Anyway, in trying to develop a situation, I found out that I had done nothing unusual. I'd done nothing out of the ordinary. They didn't know what my money was. So it was nothing to do but go back to the post and turn in my leave. And because I didn't have any money, I volunteered for some field duty. And 2 or 3 weeks later, I'm out in the field with this driving this lieutenant's Jeep. And I walk in this German guest house, and the people who ran it lived in the back. And there was a curtain between the front and the back. And when I walked in that guest house, there was an old iron bed back in the back that they slept in. And when I saw that bed, I remembered what I had done with my money. There was a bed just like it in that hotel back in Munich. I stuck it up in the leg of that bed. Now, when you're making $40 a month and you're drunk half the time and you've lost $200, it'll concern you. But when you know where it is and can't get back to it, it'll drive you crazy as hell. Sure enough, a couple of weeks later, I made it back to town and went in and found out where I was and raised the bed and the money fell out. And I just blew it. I never did make it crash. But anyway, that was a blackout. I didn't know it. I didn't know what it was. I thought these guys who went downtown and had 2 or 3 beers and got drunk occasionally did the same thing I did. I did not know that it was an indication of alcoholism. I came back from service and I went to High Point College. I got a part-time job and Peggy got her 2 or 3 and jobs, and we went to college. Me in college and her raising kids. And I had a daughter by this time, and my son was born while I was in school. And I wanted to be a traveling salesman. I always wanted, all my life, I wanted to be a traveling salesman. And the reason was I knew that there was you drank a lot of liquor, you made a lot of money, you didn't have to work much. And that's my idea. And so I kept trying to get a job, and finally a guy gave me a job selling cement in Roanoke, Virginia. And we moved to Roanoke, Virginia on expense account. I had an expense account. Now, I didn't take any architects to lunch or any building contractors to dinner. Me and a bunch of bricklayers got drunk after work every afternoon. And you'd be surprised how much cement I sold with drunk bricklayers at a place called Melrose Barbecue. I was selling hell out because they wouldn't use anybody but my stuff. We had a deal down one time. They had a union local down in Bristol, and they had a union local up in Virginia, and I was a bricklayer. I'd learned it, and I used to be a bricklayer. And they decided we'd open a local in Pulaski. This never took place, but they decided we'd open a local in Pulaski, and they'd make me president of it. And then if we went on a job and my mortar mix wasn't on that job, we'd just close it down. We had to get that going and never did get it. It seems like none of these good ideas I have come up with ever come to fruition. I'll tell you about one that took place this week. I got 3 friends that had anniversaries last night back in High Point. One guy got 10 years, and one got 4, and a guy's got 2. And a good friend of mine was speaking at this meeting. And they wanted me to introduce the speaker. And I said, well, I'm going to be up in Michigan. And we hit on this idea last week, a little retreat, of putting a speakerphone on the podium. And me to be wherever I was with a speakerphone, and we'd call in, and I would introduce the speaker from Toledo. But we never could get it worked out. Seems like a lot of these harebrained ideas, fortunately, don't come about. Anyway, in Roanoke, Virginia, Peggy and I started having what I refer to as domestic difficulties. That's when you come in drunk every night, your wife's mad as hell, all the time. And she'd ask these dumb questions like, you know, why do you get drunk every night? And I'd tell her, and I believed it. It's part of the job. All salesmen get drunk every night. I'm entertaining customers. So how much of them bricklayers down Melrose going to buy? So they're not going to buy a lot, but they're going to make sure that the guy they work for buys it. And that's, we started doing this. I started having somewhat blackouts there, doing stupid things. Peggy and I went to dinner with a customer one night. Kids were small and we had a babysitter. And back then you could get a babysitter in Virginia 50 cents an hour. Those days are gone. Wish they were back. But we came back and I owed this little gal $4 for babysitting. And I gave her $4. I gave her a 10 and a 5 and 2 1s. And this is back in the 60s, and I couldn't afford $17 for a babysitter, and I damn sure couldn't put it on expense account. Peggy had to go over the next morning. Her father called and said, I believe Mr. Hoover gave this young lady too much money. And I did. She probably went back and told her daddy how drunk I was when I came. Anyway, I was like a lot of other drunks. I kept falling upstairs. I kept getting better jobs. And I got a better job from this, and we went back to High Point, and I went to work for a local company there, manufacturer of school buses. And I was a regional manager, and I worked the western half of the United States. And this is the perfect job for a budding alcoholic. I was gone 2-3 weeks at a time. I spent weekends in places like Los Angeles and Las Vegas and San Francisco. I got snowed in places like Burley, Idaho. But if you want a job, if you're here in the room tonight and you're not alcoholic, but you'd like to be, and you want a job that will guarantee it, see me after the meeting. I'll tell you where to send your application. These people assisted me in the acceleration of my illness. I was alcoholic before they ever heard of me, but I accelerated to the point, and I'm grateful for this. When I finally got sober, I was 35 years old. And I could have continued until I was 40 or 50 or died. But the job that I had assisted me in accelerating this illness to the point that I finally got sober. And I got sober at what I considered an early age. But I started having further domestic difficulties here. And, you know, Peggy could stay on my back all the time about my coming in and getting drunk on the weekend when I was home. And I used to say to her, you know, well, I'm out working all week. I'm gone 2-3 weeks, and there's a lot of pressure, and I'm coming in, I'm unwinding. And the truth of the matter was, had I come in from those trips and not drank, I'd have been DTing it. And so I had to drink to make it through the weekend. She was having all she could stand of my illness. She didn't know what to do. And the people I was working for were catching up with me. I was beginning to hear some small comments, you know. I didn't attach any significance to this until after I got sober. My boss said to me one time, do you know that we've got 4 members of our organization in Alcoholics Anonymous? He, for no reason other than he just said that. I said, no, I didn't. I didn't know we had them. Lucky them. I didn't realize it several years later. He was hinting to me to do something. Anyway, I left that company and took a job with another company. We moved to Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. And we just were through there yesterday, first time in about 13, 14 years we've been there. And we tried to visit some old people. I don't think it was a very good visit for Peggy. She's had a lot of bad memories from that town because Peggy didn't want to go to Beaver Falls. I took this job, and she didn't want to go. She had her home, and she had her roots, and she had her family in High Point, and I was drunk all the time. And she didn't want to go. And I'm a good salesman. I always have been. I can talk her into anything now. And I said to her, honey, the problem is my job and the pressure and the travel. Why don't we move, and I promise you I won't travel so much, and I won't drink so much. And so she bought this line, and we moved to Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. And I stayed sober a couple of days. Drank anything at all. But I'm going to tell you what I found up there. I found a glorious place. In North Carolina, and Clyde can tell you this, North Carolina, we just got liquor by the drink a few years ago, just 2 or 3 years ago. And there's no such thing as mixed drinks. And, you know, I learned to drink booze out of a bottle. And you chase it with, you know, cigarettes or apples or creasy greens or, you know. Most of y'all know what creasy greens are, you know. But anyway, I went to Pennsylvania, and these cats are sitting out in public with a shot and a beer. And I'd never done that except in my kitchen. I used to be out on Saturday morning when I was trying to get well. But here these people were. If you go in North Carolina and say, I want a shot and beer, they know you're drunk. But up there was doing public, and I was at home. I remember we walked in this first little time, Peggy and I went out that night. She got one funny little drink, you know, pink with all that fuzzy stuff on it, you know. You can't get to the liquor for all that fruit. And I ordered a shot and a beer. And she said, "My God, you're going to drink, you know, like never seen anybody drink that way. I love to drink that way." So I was in hog heaven up there. We were only up there a year. And the only benefit, the only thing good that ever came out of the year that I spent in Beaver Falls was the fact that the seed of recovery was planted in me there. I did not believe in God for a long time in my life. I grew up in the church, and I got old enough to say there ain't no God, and I didn't get struck dead, and I believed it. And so I threw God out a long time ago, and I didn't want to have anything to do with him. And so up there in Pennsylvania, I know today our trip there was God-inspired. God directed us into Pennsylvania because it was there that I met my first recovering alcoholic. Now, we got a lot of Baptists back home that get sober and quit drinking and got 8 Bibles under each arm, and they walk around with a face this long, and they're sorry as hell they're sober. And I've seen a lot of them guys, and I didn't want to be that way. But I walked into Beaver, we went into Beaver Falls, and we was only up there a year, and I met a guy that was happy all the time. Always happy. His name was Ned. He worked for one of my distributors, and there was a truck distributor down there, and he was happy and he was laughing all the time. He didn't drink liquor. And I didn't understand that. Couldn't understand it at all. I had been out for lunch with him for dinner, and he didn't drink. And I didn't know why. And one night we were on a plane going to the home office, and the stewardess came by and said, the fellow was flying first class. He said, "You want something to drink?" And I said, "Yeah, 2 bourbons and 7 up." And he said to her, 2 bourbons and 7 up for me too. And when she brought them by, he put the bourbon on my tray and said, "Here, Roy, you drink the bourbon, I'll drink the 7 up, it'll give you 4. And I said, "Ned, you don't drink at all, do you?" And he told me the wildest story I've ever heard. Story of losing things, you know, families, money, fortunes, businesses. And at that time, material possessions were my God. And so I could not understand how a human being losing everything that he had lost could be as happy as this man was. Didn't understand it, but I listened. And he told me that he belonged to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had been sober for about 5 years. And this sometime in 1968 or 69. And I put it in the back. I didn't want to pursue it. You know, I don't know how you were, but if I was reading the paper and a little bitty column down here in the bottom said something about alcoholism, I'd turn the page right quick. Yeah, I wasn't about to read that. And so I didn't pursue that conversation. I just put it in the back of my mind. And we left Pennsylvania, came back to North Carolina. And sometime in the year 1970, I don't know whether it was January or September, I have no idea, but I know in the year 1970, I came to on the floor one morning. My drinking by this time had reached that point where I was passed out a lot of the time, in the bed dragging the clock around. And Peggy was gone, and the kids were gone, and I didn't know where they were. And I came to one morning, and I remembered what this man had told me. And at that point in my life, I knew, I had realized that maybe I would have started thinking about doing something about my drinking. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol 10 years before I ever heard Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that once I started drinking, I could not predict my behavior, nor would I know when I would quit. I also knew that I could not quit without some serious situation occurring. I'd known that for 10 years, but I didn't know what to do about it. But suddenly this morning, I remembered what this man had told me a couple of years before about him. He made the perfect 12-step call on me. He told me what happened to him and never mentioned my drinking. So I chased him down on the phone that morning. I called where he worked, and they said he no longer worked there, but they told me where he did. And I called him, and I remember what I said to him. I said, "Ned, I think I've got a drinking problem." And he like to broke up on the other end of the line. He said, "I sure am glad you know it. Everybody else that knows you got a drinking problem." But the man gave me, and I don't remember what he told me, but I remember what he said. He gave me hope. that maybe possibly I would not have to be like I was, but could be like he was. That was his message to me that morning. And his advice was, call Alcoholics Anonymous in High Point and do what they tell you to do. And when I hung up from talking to him, I had the answer to my problem. Now, if there's some new people here tonight, you're wondering what's happening in your life. We don't give much advice in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm going to give you a piece of advice. If you don't know what's wrong with you, call Alcoholics Anonymous and do what they tell you to do. It's the answer to every drunk's problem. So I took part of his advice. I just called AA. And I got a hold of the guy that was to become my first sponsor. And he said he didn't have time to come out and see me right then. He was tied up with something that was quite important. But he would send somebody. And it was the only time in the next few years until he died, it's the only time that I ever remember him not having time for me. But it must have been something that time. But he sent a guy out to see me. And he said, I'll send him out to your house and tell him where I live. And I said, no. But this time I'd gone business with my brother-in-law. I had a little furniture factory down there. I said, no, don't send him to the house. I've got to go to the office. I ain't been to the office in 3 weeks. Place is running better without me than it ever did when I was there. But it was important that I get there. And so I told him where the office was, and he said, I'll send a guy to see you. And so I went out and inspected the car, and there was nothing wrong with the automobile. It wasn't torn up. So I didn't know anything. And I called around, found out where Peggy was, the kids. And in her conversation, she indicated she had not filed divorce papers yet. And so things were not looking as badly as they had 15 minutes before. So I then went to South Main, Texaco, and that's a bit of a misnomer. That gas station's never sold gas. They sell Budweiser and Schlitz and bootleg Coors and a shot under the table. And so I went by the South Main Texaco and got me a shot and a couple of drinks and a couple of beers. And then I was sort of sorry I'd call that A&A bunch. And I thought maybe I'd made a mistake. So I went down to my office and I got me a vodka bottle out of the back of the desk and had a couple of drinks. And I knew by then, of course, I had made the mistake of calling Peggy and tell her that I had called A&A. And that excited her. You know, I could have told her I'd called the left-handed guru of Saipan, tickle hell out of her if it was going to cure me from drinking. And she came flying down to the plant, and by this time the guy came in my office. And when he walked into my office, I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous would work because I had known him in his drinking period. And here he was sober. I hadn't seen him. Last time I'd seen him, he was drunk and shaking. And he walked in my office, and his hair was combed, and his face had cleared up, and his hands no longer shook. And he told me he'd been sober 2 or 3 years. And he was working the same job a couple of years, and this guy never held a job over 6 months. And I knew something was right in his life. And Peggy came in, and they were insistent that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Now, I didn't want to go. I told you, I've had these drinks, and I'm beginning to wonder if maybe I hadn't been a little bit premature on this quitting drinking, you know. But they insisted I go, and I did appreciate Jack coming to see me. Now, I knew he needed to work. You know, he hadn't worked for years. He needed to work, and here he was taking time off to come talk to me. And it was important to Peggy, and I had done nothing constructive in our marriage for a while. So I decided that I'd go to AA meeting because they wanted me to. And I walked into my first AA meeting sometime in 1970, I don't know when it was. And the only thing that I remember about that meeting is the people were nice to me. I felt comfortable in that first meeting. I don't remember what happened. I remember they gave me some stupid advice. I remember that. Still remember. They all gave me their phone number. And they said, if you feel like drinking, call us and we'll talk you out of it. Oh, that's the dumbest thing I've heard. If I want to drink, why the hell I want somebody to talk me out of it? But anyway, I left and Peggy and I were sort of holding hands as we left, and so I said, I'll go back again. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous fairly regularly after that until I got drunk. And I don't know how long. It was a week, 2 weeks, 6 weeks. I have no idea. But I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went there until I got drunk. And I stayed drunk until I couldn't drink anymore, and I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stayed the second time until I got drunk again. And between sometime in 1970 in March of 15th, 1972, I know I returned to nine times. Because I got nine of those aluminum tokens. We give these little tokens, you know. And I got nine of them. I don't know how many other times I went and didn't get a token. But I was not doing things right when I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not doing exactly right. There were a couple parts of this program I didn't like. One of them was God, and the other was not drinking. I didn't like those two parts. And if you take God and not drinking out of Alcoholics Anonymous, there ain't a hell of a lot left. I was running around with losers, and by that I mean some real bad ones. We took turns getting drunk. I didn't like that cat, those cats who were staying sober and telling the truth and trying to pay their debts and all. I didn't like that. They're talking about God and they're praying in the morning. I wasn't about to do that. I'd thrown God out of my life and I knew he didn't want anything else to do with me. But anyway, I started hanging around with a bunch of these losers. And we got to the point where none of us liked that crowd that was staying sober. So we decided to form our own group. And we formed a group. We formed a group and we called it the Forest Hills Group. And the sober crowd over in New South called it Slippers Anonymous. We would meet there on Sunday night and take everybody's inventory but ours. I remember one night, and this is true, one Sunday night, we were there, and so one of us had been to that New South group, and somebody had had a two-year birthday or 3 years or something. There weren't that many people in that day in High Point back then. And we came in that Sunday night meeting, and somebody said something about, some guy been sober 2 years. And I said, well, how long we been sober? And we got to counting up, and there were nine of us in that meeting that night. So help me God, we had 11 days between us. The next night, we were all drunk. But I want to tell you about that night. Tonight, in Alcoholics Anonymous, four of that nine is sober. Four of us are sober. I've got 11 years, and Kim's got 8. Darlene's got 10. And John's got 6 or 8, somewhere along in there. And two of those guys are out. We don't know where they are. They're around town. We don't know if they're sober or drunk, but they're not in AA. And three are dead. And I contend that 4 out of 9 of that crowd is a hell of an average. So I want to give you another piece of advice if you're new in this program. If you don't like the winners, come to AA with the losers, but just keep coming. And if your loser gets drunk, get you another loser to come with. And you will one day be sober unless you die. That's a risk you must take. But keep coming back to AA even if you have to come with losers. It's a sight better than staying out and not making it. I want to tell you why, about some of the things that would happen to me when I was out in this period of time. I would be driving home from work one Monday, and I would be sober for maybe as long as 6 weeks in AA, going to AA every Monday and Thursday. And everything would be good in my life, and maybe the Sunday night meeting too, I don't know. My wife would be speaking to me, and the business would be prospering or not going broke. And things would be sort of stable in my life, and I would be driving home, and the insanity of alcoholism, as I understand it, will overtake me. Slapping a cop in the mouth when you're drunk ain't insane. You can give my mother enough of that stuff and she'll do that. The insanity is taking a drink after you slapped him in the mouth when you're cold sober and out of jail. And that's what would happen to me. I would be driving home cold sober. Everything in my life would be good. And it would suddenly occur to me that all those guys in AA are alcoholic, but I'm not. And I know that I can drink one beer. And I'd stop at Smitty's Grill over there and go in and get a beer. And Smitty would say, you want another one, Roy? And I'd say, no, I'm going to cut my grass. And I'd leave on Monday, go home and cut my grass. One beer. And Tuesday, driving home from work, I would say, well, I know they're alcoholic, and I know I'm not. And I know yesterday I had a beer, and it didn't bother me, and to prove it, I'm going to go home today and not even drink one. And I'd go home and not even drink one. And Wednesday, I'd come by, and I would say the same thing. Monday, I had one beer, and Tuesday, I didn't have one at all. And today, I'm going to get a draft and get me a king size to go. And I'd go in and get a draft, get me a king size to go, and the next thing I'd know it'd be Monday again, I'd be in jail in South Carolina. Wondering what the hell happened. And I'd drink as long as I could drink, and I'd go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. 1971, my brother-in-law and I flipped a coin for the business. And we really did. It had, between his craziness and my drunkenness, we destroyed a pretty good little plant. And we flipped a coin for it, and I don't know yet whether I won or lost, but I left. And I borrowed $3,000 from a banker that didn't know me and bought a country grocery store to try to stay out of the road and stay out of the way. I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous would not work for me. I had been here a year and a half, and it did not work. And I'm cold sober sometime around the 10th of January. I haven't had a drink since back maybe Thanksgiving or before Christmas, but I know it's been that long. And I'm working this store at 6 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock at night. I haven't had a drink. And a guy drives into my store at 6:30 in the morning, and he's got a pint of rocking rye. And he says he's got a lot of congestion down his chest. And his wife doesn't allow him to drink at home. And he wonders if he might be hide this pint out in this old shed I got and just take him a little drink now and then. And I said, sure. And he says, sort of as he goes out the door, you sound like you got a cold. And I say, I have. He says, why don't you take you a little nip of this and see if it'll help? Now, I'm cold sober and I have been for a period of time. I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous for 18 months. I've heard you say 1,000 times, the first drink you take, you cannot predict what you're going to do, and you cannot quit once you start and do your cycles run. I've heard you say that. I've proven it to myself time and again. I just told you about it. And yet that morning when he said that, the thought crossed my mind, if I had a pint of liquor, rock and rye, up under the counter to sort of cut the congestion, medicinal purposes only, it would be all right, and it would probably last me 30 days. I haven't had a drink in 11 and a half years. If I go back to drinking tomorrow, a pint of liquor won't last me 2 drinks, and it wouldn't then. And so I took that drink, and it helped, and I said to him, why don't you, when you come home this afternoon, bring me a pint of rockin' rye? And he said he would be glad to. And I'm working the store, and when he came into the store that afternoon at 4:30, I'd done fished around in that old building and found his pint and drank it. And I sent one of the guys from the farmers hung around the store over to the community bootlegger to buy me a fifth vodka, and I'd done consumed that. And I was walking up and down in front of those gas pumps when he drove up wondering where the hell he was with my liquor. And that started what I hoped was my last drink. I drank all I could drink, and I would average at least fifth, maybe 2/5 a day. From sometime in January, 10th or 15th of January, to 15th of March, 1972. When I came to on the 15th of March, Peggy was gone. Kids were gone. Peggy's brother, uncle, and grandfather were running my store. I was laying on the bed, running the clock around. I was an insane idiot. I came to that morning, March 15th, 1972. It's the most important day of my life. It was then, I didn't know it. It is today, and I know it. I came to, and I've never been as disgusted. I've never been as full of self-hate. I've never been as alone or lonesome as I was that morning in my entire life. I knew that everything in the world rotten was because of me. And I cried out to a God that I did not believe in. I said, God, if there's a God, I need help. And I got instant relief. It suddenly became very clear to me that there was a God, there always had been, and it was me that was wrong. It suddenly became very clear that all of my problems were because I was alcoholic. And that the answer to all my problems lay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a feeling of contentment, peace, and serenity overcame me that morning. It didn't last all that long. I never have known it before or since. But that morning I knew that everything was going to be all right. I got up off of that floor with a new attitude about life. I was going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to do what they told me to do. I went back that night, and I didn't associate myself with the losers of the program. I didn't go back and talk to those cats that couldn't stay sober. I went to see Joe and Frank and Jack, the guys that had been sober. And I said to Joe, I want to stay sober. And Joe said, sit down over here after the meeting and let me talk to you. Evidently, Joe saw something in me that night he had not seen before. Because he started talking to me and he spent some time with me. He gave me some advice. And I'm going to pass it on to you. He said, if you will attend 7 AA meetings a week, that's one every night, for 5 years, you will have two chances of staying sober. Slim and numb. And he said, I will consent to be your sponsor on one condition, that you do always do what I tell you to do. He said, if you're in a meeting and some chairman makes the mistake of calling on you, you look over at me, and if I think it's all right to talk, I'll nod. And if I don't, you pass. And he didn't nod for 6 months. In all this period of time that I was playing with the Pope. But about 6 months before I got sober, Peggy found out what the program of Al-Anon is all about. Ned told me what happened to him and how he had recovered from alcoholism. I saw Jack after he had recovered from alcoholism, and I had known him before. My wife is the first person I ever saw recover from the effects of alcoholism in the program Al-Anon. I saw her change before my very eyes. I used to could predict everything she was going to do and make her dance on a string like a puppet. And all that changed. I couldn't get her to dance on those strings. She is as much responsible for my sobriety, or the program Al-Anon is much responsible for my initial sobriety, as program Alcoholics Anonymous was. It changed thereafter. Joe said to me that you've got to do these things, you've got to work these programs, you've got to work these steps, you've got to do what we tell you, you've got to get rid of your defects of character. And I said, how do I do that? And he said, I'll tell you as they come up. I was living at home, and Peggy was living down at Dad's. And Peg came over to the house one time. I'd been sober about 2 or 3 days, and I told her about this spiritual experience I had, and she didn't buy that. She'd heard that before, you know, and it was now show and tell time. And the telling part was over. And she had got a hold of this Al-Anon program, and she explained to me that they were staying on the south end of town, and we live on the north end of town, and she worked in the center of town, and she had to get up every morning and drive all the way across town and get the kids ready for school and take them to school, and she had to drive back to the center of town to work and reverse that process in the afternoon. And I'm living in the house. She said that that wasn't fair because they hadn't done anything. And it really, what ought to happen is they ought to move back into the house where the routine would be established and for me to move out. And she said, I explained in a logical, sensible way, and she said, I want you to think about it. And if you don't agree that this is the proper thing to do, then say so. And I get sure to put your ass out. So I moved into the Paradise Motel. Paradise Motel is $22 a week and a room and bath. And I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings every night. And initially I had trouble physically, like I couldn't sleep. 2 o'clock in the morning I called Frank. And I'd say, Frank, I can't sleep. And Frank would say, Roy, in all my years of exposure to alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never known of a single human being who died from lack of sleep. Read the big book and he'd hang up. And I'd read the big book. The first thing you know, it's 6 o'clock time to go to work. I'd go to work and I'd work all day and I'd go to the meeting that night and I'd come back and I'd call him the next night, 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd say, Frank, I still can't sleep. say, still read the book. One morning I woke up, the alarm went off. The big book was laying on the floor. I had laid across the bed and I had been asleep, and I don't know how long. I have not had the problem sleeping since that day. And I got to read a hell of a lot of big books during that period of time. I would ask them about these character defects. How do I get rid of character defects? And I had discovered the power of prayer. And Joe would tell me to pray about it. And I did. I prayed about it. I want to relate one experience to you about how I learned to change me. When I came in this program, I didn't have resentment. Let me say this. I didn't have resentment before I came here. Mine were called hate. I only developed resentment as I got better. But I came in this program and I hated this old gal that traded at the store. And she used to drive up out there and blow the horn, and I didn't run a curb service grocery store, and so I wouldn't go out and wait on her. And we had one of those little gas pumps out there with a bell, and she'd ding-a-ling that bell, and I'd have to go out and pump her gas, because we didn't have self-service. And I'd say, you want some gas? And she'd say, no, I don't need any gas this morning. Would you bring me a pack of Cools? And I'd go back in the store and get her a pack of Cools and bring them back and give her to them, and she'd give me a $5 bill. And I'd go back in the store and get changed and come back, and she'd say, how about I need a pack of juicy fruit chewing gum. And I'd go back, and the old ditty drove me crazy. And I didn't like her. And I thought I had to hate her till she died or till she changed. And I was sitting in a meeting one night, and I made the mistake of saying something about her, and I said that woman's going to cause me to get drunk, and Joe jumped on my case with all 4 feet. He said, oh boy, you might get drunk, but it won't be her fault. He said, you find something good about this lady, and you can change from hating her to at least tolerating her and maybe love her. And I said, there ain't no damn way. There's nothing good about this old woman because I've already lived. And he said, you keep praying. And so I started praying. Every time I hear that bell ring in the morning, I'd pray. I'd say, God, please let me see something good about that old woman because I don't want to get drunk. And I came one morning. I was sitting there reading the paper, and she drove up and rang that bell, and I didn't even have to look. I knew it was her. And it suddenly came over me. My prayers were answered. This old woman was just a tolerance tester, all she amounted to. And if I could get through her every morning, there wasn't nothing upset me the rest of the day. That's all there came to. But it suddenly occurred to me that I no longer hated her. And then as time went on, I got to where I almost liked her. I was at a feed store about a year ago. I haven't seen this old bitty in 10 years. I'm in a feed store all the day, and a couple years ago, she's in there getting some garden stuff, and I'm planting some tomatoes or something. I walk in, that old woman went in there, and when I saw her, I had the sudden urge to go up and hug her. I love her. And I have been able to change from what I was to what I want to be through the power of prayer. I didn't know that when I came in here. And Joe started telling me that I had to get active with other alcoholics, that I had to go start calling on drunks. So I had one owed me a little money at the store. And he didn't want to go to AA. I said, Larry, let's go to AA. He said, I ain't going to AA. I said, how much money do you owe me? $30? Well, pay me. Well, I can't pay you. Well, I'll get you butt in the truck. We're going to AA. And I'll take you to Alcoholics Anonymous. And Peggy and I will be going to open meeting. And we'd go by to get Larry. And he'd be laid out in his drunk chair. And he'd be thrown up all over his front. And I'd say, Peggy, I'll be back in a minute. I'd go in there and I'd put him in the shower. And I'd clean him up. And I'd shave him. I'd put his clothes on. And he'd say, I don't want to go to AA. I'd say, shut up, Murphy, and get in the truck. And I carried him to AA. A couple of years ago, Larry froze to death. But God, that man kept me sober for a long period of time. I got over that carrying him to AA, but I didn't stop pursuing drunks. The benefits I've received from this program are thousands. A wife that loves me, kids that respect me, friends by the thousands, a boss and a company that I work for that allow me to do my job without too many restrictions. Self-respect that I can walk down the street and be who I am and know that I am who I am and I'm doing the best I can and I no longer hate myself. To sit in a meeting and watch somebody else get sober is the greatest benefit this program can give us. I like to be there when that new drunk comes in. I like to see them come in. I like to see them in that condition where they can't hold a cup of coffee the first night. And I like to see them get well and well and better until they're one day making coffee. And I see them with a new suit, or at least a coat and pants that match. And they come in with a girl on their arm, and I still believe, like Joe down in Texas, that a guy comes in with a woman on his arm has got a hell of a lot better chance than a guy by himself. I believe that. And I like to see them come in and get well. Become a responsible part of society. See this program work for another human being like it did for me and like it did for you. See them get a mortgage and a tax liability and an automobile and a driver's license. And become, instead of what we were, what we are capable of becoming. And I can see that in Alcoholics Anonymous every day. See it in church occasionally. Don't ever see it at the Moose Club. See that there every night. I once again would like to thank the committee for inviting me up here this weekend. I want to thank each of you for sitting out there and listening to me. And I also want to thank you for being here when I got here. Thank you.